Welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday, 8th of March, with me, Ian Welsh. Recently, I spoke with Max Doherty, Carbon Business Development Lead at Bayer Crop Science. We spoke about why a farmer-centric approach to regenerative agriculture is essential and some of the potential routes to funding for agricultural transition. It's well worth a listen. First, though, is some sustainable business news with Bea Stevenson.
It's once again been a significant week for regulations in the world of sustainable business. In the US, the SEC has approved a set of scaled-back climate disclosure rules for US public companies, requiring those in scope for the first time to report on climate risks facing their business and plans to tackle these. The rules have been significantly scaled back from the requirements of the SEC's initial March 2022 proposal. There's now no longer a requirement for Scope 3 emissions reporting, for instance, and the new rules scale back Scope 1 and 2 emissions requirements, which will now only apply to large filers and only when they're deemed to be material. SEC Chair Gary Gensler has noted that many larger companies will nevertheless be required to report on all three emissions scopes in order to comply with reporting requirements introduced in other jurisdictions, including, of course, Europe under the EU's Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. Overall, the next 2 years will see a real increase in corporate sustainability due diligence as these regulations come into play. In the EU this week, negotiators are striving for a compromise on EU corporate supply chain rules, aiming to salvage the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, which failed to win a majority of member state votes last week. Led by Germany and Italy, major EU nations have opposed the law, which mandates companies to scrutinise supply chains for human rights and labour violations. A draft circulated by Belgium proposes doubling the thresholds for affected businesses to 300 million euros and increasing the minimum employee number to 1,000. It also limits civil liability rules and implements a phased approach for smaller companies. The proposal awaits endorsement, with the formal talks underway to resolve differences ahead of the European Parliament elections. Against this tense backdrop, protesters outside the French embassy are urging governments to prioritise environmental protection and human rights. The European Parliament and Council presidency have reached a preliminary agreement on the packaging and packaging waste regulation, introducing a range of substantial measures aimed at addressing various facets of packaging-related environmental concerns. The rules include new binding reuse targets for 2030, as well as indicative targets for 2024, on top of a requirement for member states to separately collect at least 90% of single-use plastic bottles and metal beverage containers every year by 2029. Another new measure is a ban on food contact packaging containing PFAS or forever chemicals. Whilst applauding the regulation, Zero Waste Europe has criticised some exemptions, seemingly to the benefit of paper-based and composite packaging companies. For instance, the exclusion of paper-based packaging from market restrictions measures and the exemption of cardboard packaging from reuse targets. Zero Waste Europe and a coalition of environmental NGOs have called for the European Parliament to ratify the rules swiftly and advocated for high ambition and proper implementation of the regulation. Data released by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization this week has shown once again that women in rural areas in developing countries are suffering substantially greater economic losses from the impacts of climate breakdown than their male counterparts. Women-led households in rural areas lost around 8% more of their income due to heat stress than male-headed households, and face a reduction in income of about 3% greater than men when struck by flooding, the report shows. The overall gap across the world's lower middle-income countries totals to around an extra $37 billion to the detriment of women from heat stress and $16 billion from flooding each year. The research also suggests that as the climate crisis worsens, this trend is likely to continue. Deputy Director of Inclusive Rural Transformation and Gender Equality at the FAO and a co-author of the report, Lauren Phillips, said that governments were failing to take into account the factors that disadvantage women and that climate aid should be targeted in ways that will address the gender gap.
Next up is a conversation I had a few days ago with Max Doherty, Carbon Business Development Lead at Bayer Crop Science. So we're going to talk a bit about the rise and rise of regenerative agriculture. Max, it does feel that the sector is coalescing around regen ag as the solution to many challenges. To what extent do you agree with that? And if so, why do you think it is?
I really agree with it. If we take a step back, the industry recognizes that two of the most pressing issues of the century facing society will be climate and food security, and that those two things are inextricably linked to each other. Ultimately, we need to figure out and embrace the tension of feeding a growing population of 10 billion people by 2050, while also dealing with the fact that the agri-food sector accounts for somewhere between 20 to 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions, and that even the current production system, by some estimates, may lead to the degrading of up to 20% of the world's arable soils. And so I think the thing that's really interesting is that we believe that Regen Ag can actually be a solution to both of those challenges at the same time. We think Regen Ag can help farmers improve their productivity while using less and restoring the natural ecosystems on which we all rely. It's for that reason that there's growing consensus and enthusiasm about the role that Regen Ag can play. But I also think, Ian, it's important to not forget that the entire food system relies on farmers. That's why we're talking about Regen Ag and not Regen Food, right? The foods that we consume start with farmers that are sowing seeds, they're growing their crops and raising their animals. This is going to be successful. We got to recognize that if farmers' businesses are disrupted, the entire industry's businesses, as well as society. So that's something everybody needs to be thinking about. And I think a big reason why Regen Ag is such a key topic right now.
What do you think, in general terms, the whole agricultural transformation will look like?
If we try and describe the regenerative transformation of the food system at a high level, it's producing more while using less, while also restoring the health of the natural ecosystems on which we all rely. But if you dig in a little bit further and ask yourself, well, how do we know we're actually successful in delivering on this vision based on the outcomes? There's four principles that really are at the center of it for us. First and foremost, are we making farmers more productive? Second, are we making farmers more profitable? Third, are we improving the climate resilience of those farms, as well as actively mitigating climate change through reducing the farming ecosystem's emission profile, as well as harnessing the natural carbon sinks of their operations, while also, fourth, improving the overall ecosystem's health. That includes things like biodiversity, water quality, soil health. I think those are some of the things that we can anchor ourselves to in terms of a North Star and guiding vision. But I think the thing that's equally important in all that is for the transformation to be successful, us to actually realize that described vision, we have to keep the farmer at the center of everything that we're doing if we're going to successfully cultivate this change.
So why is a farmer-centric focus so important, and what does it look like?
There's this old adage in product development that really resonates for me, and it states that if you don't go, you don't know. The point of that is that if you're not actually in the field, if you're not connecting with your customers, empathizing with their problems, you're never actually really going to understand the uniqueness of their situation and really find insight that is sufficient to design solutions that actually add value. Look, our present moment and challenge with regenerative agriculture is no different. We really need to be there in the field, partnering with farmers, not just in the US, but truly around the globe to co-create solutions that can be practically implemented if we're going to achieve the positive outcomes on those principles that I mentioned earlier and address the overall objective, which is solving climate and food security through regenerative agriculture as a solution.
So that's going to require quite a change in approach then. In a commoditized world, there's a massive disconnect between farmers and the ultimate buyers and users of the products. How do you think that can be overcome going forwards?
The way that we can ultimately try and bridge that connection is by doing our best to facilitate the regenerative transformation with a farmer-centric approach that then connects to value chain collaboration, where we're connecting these long supply chains that are capital intensive, that are well established, to the outcomes that the farmer is having. Whether it's through claims or branded products, we have to really look at how we bring the impact at the field level all the way into the consumer and the corporate use case.
There's clearly a lot to do. So what do you think are the processes that are necessary to ensure that we tick all the boxes here in terms of progress of things like impacts and better yields?
The way that we think about this is in terms of systems transformation. It can't just be merely change. And that requires both a top-down and bottoms-up approach. And let's take those one at a time. From the top-down perspective at Bayer, we spend over $3 billion a year on research and development to advance scientific innovation to ultimately bring value-added solutions to farmers around the world. In the past, those investments were mostly directed to improving productivity and profitability, which are still of critical importance, as we've talked about these principles of regenerative agriculture. But what's changed is now we're looking at our entire research and development portfolio and asking, how do these innovations not only increase productivity and profitability, but also increase climate resilience and enhance the natural ecosystems? We think that innovations that come from our core platforms, like, for example, plant breeding and our new short stature corn hybrids, which we could talk more about if you'd like, will be a major contributor to driving those regenerative outcomes. And this is important, a scalable and systems level. I think then equally from the bottoms up approach, look, that just comes down to, are we listening and learning to farmers on a continuous basis? That really means figuring out the right combination of agronomic support, expertise, tools, and incentives that actually fit into the unique context, right, of each individual farmer operation. And I think if we can do both of those things from the top and from the bottom, we really can stand to be successful.
I just want to think about funding for a bit. What are the key considerations when thinking about how this transformation that you've been talking about is funded?
It's a terrific and important question, right? We're all, I think, always asking who pays. It's something that's on everybody's mind, right? Is it the consumer? Is it the brands? Is it the intermediate value chain? I think it's going to depend on the use case and the value chain in questions. Our view is that market-based solutions that connect, and this is really important, the food production system and regenerative outcomes to branded product level demand signals will actually have a major impact. And that companies that can best position themselves within that theme will be able to turn investments into regenerative agriculture and decarbonization into competitive advantage. Let's look at the broader picture and expand the aperture a little bit. Look at where consumer sentiment is moving. Right, for the first time, you actually really see, and you all at the Innovation Forum know this as well as anybody, sizable swaths of consumers around the globe, particularly Gen Z and millennials, who are increasingly making purchasing decisions based on whether a brand or product aligns with their core values. Again, going back to the discussion that we were just having about preserving and representing the regenerative outcome all the way through the value chain, if we can do that with companies and actually help them make products that align with these core values, a growing segment of consumers that represent a growing amount of purchasing power, we may be able to find ourselves in a position where we can unlock premiums within those brands that help catalyze regenerative outcomes across the entire value chain.
You talked about market-based solutions and their usefulness. Are the voluntary carbon markets going to help here, do you think?
The voluntary carbon market is very closely, right, related to the point that we just discussed about funding. Companies are increasingly making public commitments, right? Setting their ambition to their stakeholders, to their customers, to their investors about achieving their climate goals. And equally, I think there's a real opportunity across industry segments for companies to turn environmental stewardship into a competitive advantage by taking a leadership position on climate. That leads to potential improvements in brand reputation, potential increases in revenue and customer loyalty, all while locking capital flows that can benefit farmers and the environment. So I think there's definitely an important role here for environmental market mechanisms to play.
Can you share some examples, some case studies then, where Regen Agri has worked well in practice?
I'd like to talk actually about a couple of examples of projects and work that we're doing at Bayer with some of our collaborators in the value chain. We work with companies positioned at every segment of agri-food, whether it's grain aggregators or ingredient processors or brands. And we partner with them to identify how best we can deploy our technologies and capabilities to come behind their climate and Regen Ag roles. So I'll give you a couple, one closer to the customer downstream and one a little bit more upstream. Downstream, we've been working with Mars Petcare to actually help them decarbonize their portfolio of pet foods, including brands like Pedigree. And we're doing this by partnering with growers representing 200,000 acres of commodity production who overlap between Bayer and connection to our Regen Ag platform and then Mars's commodity sourcing footprint. And we're working to deploy millions of dollars to farmers across the US to ultimately support their region ag transition, help decarbonize their commodity production, and ultimately improve the environmental profile of Mars's pet foods that they're selling to consumers around the world. Another example that we're really excited about is some of the work that we're doing with Purdue Farms, one of the nation's largest agricultural, and this is in the US, products and animal protein producers. And in that collaboration, what we're doing that's unique is we're actually partnering with the farmers that are directly in Purdue's value chain, helping them adopt regenerative agriculture practices that are sequestering carbon in the soil and decarbonizing the overall emissions profile of the grains that they're then selling to Purdue, which are then translated and turned into ingredients, feed, and animal products like broiler, chicken, poultry, leading to those products being produced in an increasingly environmentally friendly fashion that Purdue can then bring to both its business-to-business and business-to-consumer segments, including an ambition to actually here and over the coming year launch a product line with hundreds of millions of pounds of chicken that has a significantly lower emissions profile compared to the traditional way of doing things. So I think, again, to your question, where is Region Ag working? It gets back to this theme of how do we connect the brand and consumer level use case all the way through the value chain to the farm gate and drive and incentivize that change in the production system. Those are a few examples that we're really excited about.
How are the drivers between relationships between suppliers and the end buyers? How are these relationships changing? And what's driving the Regen Ag approach?
It comes back to the opportunity for companies to turn an investment in climate action and regenerative agriculture into a competitive advantage. There are a lot of companies that recognize the need to do the right thing, but that by doing the right thing and being a responsible steward of your environmental balance sheet and of the ecosystem on which your business relies, you can also begin to turn that into differentiation, particularly with increasingly environmentally conscious consumers that fully recognize that there's a climate emergency unfolding and that companies that are taking those right steps are companies that they want to be brand loyal and continue to invest into. So I think the recognition that there's a real problem here that needs to be solved, that companies need to do the right thing, but that there's also potentially an opportunity here to unlock by doing so.
The examples you shared just now demonstrate the importance of collaboration, and it is something that everyone talks about all the time. What are the keys to ensuring that collaboration is effective, Pierre?
Look, these supply chains are long, well-established, and capital-intensive. So if we want to move fast, we actually need to figure out how to leverage the existing infrastructure that's already in place. And everyone has their respective strengths and competencies at each link in that chain. Our view is the key to acceleration is structuring collaboration in a way that unlocks the complementarities and respective skill sets and strengths of each entity in the ecosystem. With that said, I think, and we talked about this a little bit already, effectively enabling this type of collaboration starts with having, first and foremost, high quality data and reporting throughout the value chain, ensuring that the impact that the farmer is having and the region outcomes that they're delivering are represented at each stage in the value chain. You've heard the term before, we can't let the signal get lost in the noise. Otherwise, our ability to reward and incentivize the growers that are doing the work to change the production system won't be adequately rewarded. If you're not adequately rewarded, you're probably not going to be involved in a whole lot of change, which obviously just impedes progress. This is a key point that we can't miss as we think about the collaboration model. And it's one of the reasons why at Bayer, we've invested billions of dollars into building the industry's leading digital farming platform to make it easier to translate field data into actual insights for farmers and for the value chain more broadly.
What are you going to be looking out for then in the next few months?
One of the things that excites me the most as I look ahead into the future is really how we're going to progress from only thinking about how regen practices and measuring those outcomes have an impact to thinking actually about the combined impact of regen ag practices and innovative agricultural products. And what I mean by that is when we step back and really think about what needs to happen to get us on a path, not just to achieve our near-term or mid-term goals, but actually to achieve the long-term goal of net zero across the agri-food sector to truly avoid a climate disaster, there's going to need to be some real breakthrough technologies and innovations. Therefore, we can't only be thinking, as I said, about the near midterm. We have to be thinking about how we partner to achieve the long-term goals. And for us at Bayer, what we're orienting our innovation engines of plant breeding, biotech, small molecules, biologicals, digital farming around are really towards introducing novel product solutions that can drive regenerative outcomes like better soil health, restored biodiversity, and improve climate resilience, all while boosting farmer productivity and profitability. And so what I want to finish this in terms of what really I'm excited about and looking for is how we can combine those innovations of product solutions, real scientific advancement, with the region ag practices that we know today. Because I believe that will be transformative. And it's one of the reasons I'm optimistic about the future and our ability to tackle these dual challenges of climate and food security.
And how do you think the conversations are going to change getting beyond carbon and thinking more in terms of biodiversity impact as well, which feels like it might be the next big thing that we're going to be talking about?
I think that's why we're really having this broader conversation about regenerative agriculture. These individual elements of the ecosystem are interrelated and ultimately play a critical role in making sure that we can continue to foster a productive and sustainable system that meets the demands of the world today, as well as future generations. And biodiversity, like climate change, is going to be one of those critical topics that we have to steward and take into consideration as we try and progress the industry forward.
Well, it's great that there are solutions emerging. Thanks very much, Max Doherty from BioCrop Science, for taking us through some of them.
Ian, thanks so much for having us. I really enjoyed it. Look forward to talking soon.
The Innovation Forum website is, as ever, the place to go for all the latest analysis and interviews and all the details about our upcoming spring conference series and how to join us. We'll be back with a weekly briefing on Monday, but that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and until next time, goodbye.